Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2013. Lecture 6, delivered on January 31, 2013. The title of this lecture is Review of Accounting.
Today, Review of Accounting. Now, every time I teach this section about accounting, it's kind of a mixed bag. Do I go through accounting or do I set my face on fire and beat it out with an iron skillet? It's a toss-up, but I'll teach accounting. Now, I'm not going to teach a lot of accounting. What I want for you to know are the basics that we use in finance from accounting, cautioning you that we have to take accounting information and we have to rearrange it so we get something that is useful to us in finance. A lot of times we'll talk about, well, here's something on the financial statement, but really we have to think about what really is going on behind the scenes of these financial statements. Now, let me try this. Now, I assume you've all had your first accounting course. Is that right? You've had your accounting, and you came out of it relatively normal. But what's profit? Oh, that's that guy who wears a turban, and he tells you what the future. No, profit. What? Higher revenue than cost. Well, profit is the difference between your revenues and your costs. And that's always positive, right?
Yes.
No. In fact, I can show you almost every damn company I've ever run where it's negative. And that's why those companies don't exist anymore. It can be positive or negative. Revenues can be higher than costs, or costs can be higher than revenues. But remember, I caution you that this is the accounting version of it. Profit is your revenues minus your costs. But the problem is that in finance, and I'm going to start this off very clearly, in finance, we really don't care about this identity because revenue that is reported on a financial statement, on the income statement, is how much money came in, but that's not how much cash came in. Because if you had credit sales, that's not cash. That's what people owe you that shows up on your accounts receivable. So the revenues could be higher than the actual cash that comes into the drawers. And the cost is another thing, too. In accounting, you recognize a cost whether you have paid it or not. And the part that you haven't paid, it shows up as an account payable, but it's still there on the balance, on the income statement as a cost. So that distorts the cash flow. The cash in and the cash out are not the same as the revenue and the cost, respectively. Worse yet, as I told you before, accounting has to recognize actual costs that they can demonstrate. In finance, we have to look at economic costs. Not just a cost that is paid out of pocket, but it's also the costs that are opportunities that we didn't take. In other words, we have to consider both the costs that go out and the opportunity costs that did not come in. So with that caution in mind, there are some financial statements that we care about looking at in finance. And again, we'll have to do some arrangements of them, but that comes a little later. The first thing that we'll look at is the balance sheet. Now, the balance sheet has this asset side, And then it has the liabilities, liabilities, and the owner's equity. Taken together, those two add up to be the same as the assets. Now let me get something here important. So the fundamental equation of accounting is that the assets must equal the liabilities plus the owner's equity. That's not just an accounting principle. That represents something that is embedded in law. You have finally decided that you are going to pursue your dream. Your dream was simply to run a little company under your own name or under some doing business as DBA. And you're going to mow lawns. You're going to be your dream job. You want to mow lawns for rich people. So, as a sole proprietor, you keep all the money and you owe all the bills, you personally. So, in other words, if you are mowing the lawn for a rich person and you run over that rich person's poodle, it's not just a matter of, it's a matter that they're going to sue you. They are going to take everything that you own, your mower, your trimming equipment, and they are then, if that's not enough to pay for the dog, to put the dog back together again, they're going to sue you personally and take your house. They're going to take everything that you own. You see, as a sole proprietor, you are all at risk. Well, you say, well, I'm going to take a partner so that I have this risk isn't mine anymore. But nevertheless, it's still yours together. They can go right through your company and come to you personally and take your own assets. But with a corporation, they cannot do that. Because a corporation is a separate entity under the law. They can't pierce the corporate veil unless you've done something to make it so that there really isn't a corporation there. It's just you personally. Otherwise, this thing right here, this plus sign, actually represents a wall of separation between the liabilities of the corporation and the ownership position of the principals. That's why we say that the principals have the residual claim on the assets, because the liabilities can't come over here and get the owners. The worst they can do is lose their investment, but they cannot lose any more than that. And that's why the corporate model was such a triumph, because it limited the risk of entrepreneurial adventure to just what you invested. If you go belly up, the debt holders can't come through and get you. Unless you have really, really mixed your personal life with your business, and then a court might pierce the corporate veil. But for the most part, this thing is like a wall that is 10 feet tall and 10 feet thick, can't get through it. So that's why we have that kind of important, that we emphasize the importance of the corporate model. That's why when I have companies, especially anymore, I will create a corporation. That way I can't be hit personally for what has happened in the corporation that might cause huge bills or something like that. Give you a brief story. It was years ago when I was in grad school and I was taking an MBA course that I needed to finish up something that I hadn't paid attention to. It was an accounting course. And there was a person who was working for the EPA of that state when I was in there, when I was in this course. And she said, you know, in my office, we have a real big problem right now, and, you know, maybe you could help us out with it. It seemed that there was a fellow in the state. He had been running this business, And the EPA had fined him back to the Stone Age, because what he did was he just had a huge truck, and he would go to corporate companies that had toxic wastes. He would take the toxic wastes off their hands, load them into his truck, literally barrels, and then he would just go out and dump them in the rivers and streams and fields in Ohio. That was what he did. He just did it. And of course, eventually, the Ohio EPA would catch up with him, fine the company that he had created huge amounts of money. And so he'd just declare, well, the company's bankrupt. Can't pay these bills. Take my stuff away. Meanwhile, he'd walk away with huge money that he'd paid himself, and he'd go on his way. And then he would create another corporation, just like the first one, 6 months later, back in business. And, of course, the companies that were creating the toxic waste, they would put their hands up, hey, we contracted in good faith with this guy. So he was making a fortune by simply setting up corporations. The idea that the EPA had was, look, we're going to take this guy to court. We're going to stop this bankruptcy crap by saying that there really wasn't a corporate wall there. He was the company. And he was setting these up as essentially collapsible corporations so that he could conduct business, run up huge bills, and then walk away when the fines hit him. No matter how big the fines were, all the EPA could get was the liquidated value of a stupid truck and a few other things. So they petitioned the court to pierce the corporate veil, go through the corporation and get to his assets, which were enormous. Several nice houses in different states, nice cars, lots of furniture, and all that kind of stuff. And I, unfortunately, provided some expert witness testimony, and I walked out with a boot mark in my ass from his lawyer. So that was the end of that. But the court actually, you think, well, this is obvious. Well, the court was not willing to pierce the corporate veil because there was inadequate evidence that the corporation had been set up in bad faith. In other words, the complaint did not demonstrate sufficient evidence that this corporation was not legit. So they declined the effort. They declined the effort to pierce and go through and take away his owner's equity, the money he had personally. And so he just went back into business. He did this quite a few times, and it has a happy ending, though, because he was dumping all this ungodly toxic waste out, personally doing it himself in the fields and streams. Eventually, he got brain cancer and died pretty horribly, but that was a happy ending. But that gives you an idea of the importance of this corporate veil. So we got our balance sheet. That's one of the financial statements. Now, that represents the assets, the liabilities, and the owner's equity position. Now, the next one would be the income statement, which represents the revenues that came in and the costs and the interest payments and taxes and any residual that could be claimed by the owners, the net income. Profit, by the way, is such a dirty word. We like to say net income. Now, there's another one that is use that we are more interested in finance, and I won't get into it too much in this class, but it's a statement of cash flows. This is the one where we rectify what is on the financial statements that's really not cash flow. So in other words, on the income statement, you will see depreciation. But we know very well there's no such thing as depreciation in a physical sense. A company does not write a check to depreciation. So we have to take that and correct that. In other words, that cost is not there, so we have to add the depreciation back to see what really happened to the cash. We know, for example, that if there is an increase in accounts payable, that is an expense that was not actually paid. So if there's an increase in accounts payable, we have to add that money back in because it really didn't go out of the company's pocket. They say it did in their expenses, but it didn't really. If revenues, if we see an increase in accounts receivable, we know very well that that means that there is revenue that the company really didn't get in its pocket. So the statement of cash flows makes those corrections. And then there are a couple of others, like the statement of retained earnings, which I'll mention just briefly. But these are the three big ones. And then, like I said, there's a statement of retained earnings. But there's one that is oftentimes overlooked in a basic accounting course, which we care a huge amount about. And I'm just kind of curious. I'm always curious. Does anyone see one financial statement that is not in this list, notwithstanding the account statement of retained earnings? Balance sheet, income statement, statement of cash flows, and then the statement of retained earnings. Is there anything that I'm leaving out that would be very important? A financial statement that is not mentioned very much, but it is a very important one, especially in finance. Is there, do you see it, any of you? You took accounting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you probably don't see it, do you? I mean, you have recognized those three, right? I hope you do. Before I try to kick it out. You see it?
I don't know what it is, no.
Interesting. It's actually, I'm not surprised by that. I'm not surprised that you've tried to forget everything in your accounting course, but there you go. Here it is. It's the notes to the financial statements. The notes. You see, those notes are the window into why the financial statements were written the way they were. Point by point, explanations of everything that went on in those financial statements. The background. Oh, well, this number went up because of this. Owner's equity increased because we gave a pile of stock to our CEO. Or something like, well, we have this, it's not in the financial statements, but we have this reserve pool that we have to build up to pay off our bonds. And that's not in there, but we have this $100 million reserve pool we have to contribute to all the time. So the notes of the financial statement are a window on why things happened in the other financial statements. And also sometimes they tell even more than just why what happened. They can give insights into management, into decision making, into who was getting bonuses, who was getting options, and all of that kind of stuff. What kinds of exposures they have in terms of litigation can sometimes show up in there. That you wouldn't see that there's a potential for a serious outflow of cash if they lose a lawsuit. It could wind up being in the notes, but nowhere else would you see that exposure, that probability of a loss of cash. So a little later in the course, when I show you how to get financial statements and read them, we'll do some reading of the tea leaves that are in these notes to the financial statement. Sometimes they're brutally honest, but a lot of financial analysts just don't even bother with them because they look boring and dry, but boy, they can pack a wallop in there. Okay, here we go. Let me start with the income statement. Truth of the matter is, the income statement is actually a piece of the balance sheet. It's a giant... It is like a side calculation, the result of which goes into the balance sheet. And so, in a way, if you were to think about this, what I'm going to do here with the income statement is actually imagine a balance sheet, and what I'm doing is I'm focusing on a tiny piece of the balance sheet, expanding it and showing why this number from the income statement shows up in the balance sheet. Essentially, the income statement is nothing but a long calculation to get a number. Here we go. Income statement. And you do have to be a little careful, and it's worth it. Oh, let me do this. Revenue. Be a little cautious with revenue, because you want to know whether that is gross revenue or net revenue. Because with a lot of companies, and this is even with mine, you'll have how much money you took in, That's your gross. But then you're going to have something called RNA, returns and allowances, which is when you count all the money that comes in, and then separately you count what happens when you have to return money to someone because of something or other that happens. So, for example, I might have, it was last October, I had a sale of $225, and the customer just bitched, said, "This doesn't look anything like it did on your website. Want my money back." So instead of having a big fight about it, well, I'll just send you your money back then. So I actually recognize the $225 as revenue, but then there's a return and allowance for $225. So we have net revenue. I've noticed that there are a couple of courses that are not finance courses where they want the students, will you shut up? Where they want the students to do something with financial statements. And they say, is there some way I can kick this thing in the ass? Yeah, there it is. They ask for gross revenue. Actually, on modern financial statements, when you look at them, you're seeing net revenue. They don't even do gross revenue as a reporting on their normal reporting financial documents. So when these students came to me, they said, it wants the gross revenue. And that's right here. Is that right? And I said, actually, no. When it says revenue there, that's net revenue. So you're going to have to back up into the notes of the financial statement, find out what was the returns and allowances, and then add those back in to get up to the gross revenue. Turned out, as I found out later when I got my ass eaten off by the professor, well, I meant net revenue. I didn't know there was a difference. Oh, okay, well, now you do. But do be cautious when you're asked for revenue. Are they asking for the gross revenue or are they asking for the net revenue? If they say gross revenue, you're probably going to see the net revenue and you're going to have to back up into the gross revenue to get the answer, to get the number that is being required of you. Okay, so that's enough of that. Okay, now, here is cost of goods sold. These are costs that you can directly relate to the production of the product that you sold. So if I sell something for $100, but I can actually say, well, that part cost $20, that part cost $10, then those costs would be directly attributable to the $100, and therefore I would include those in cost of goods sold, as opposed to paying people to work for me, as opposed to paying my light bills, which can't be directly related to a product. Sounds like an easy distinction. It isn't, and I can tell you that for real. Because, I'm tearing my hair out right now about it, because if you think about when I produce a photographic print, okay, there's the paper, and then there's the ink. Those are directly related to the item's price. So if I sell a print for $75, I should be able to say, well, the paper, right, I can say that's a cost of goods sold, and the ink that I use to make that print, that's a cost of goods sold. But how do you do that if you're running multiple prints, some of them are fails, and you've got giant ink cartridges that you plug in and they last for maybe sometimes 20 prints, sometimes 30 prints, 40 prints? How do you attribute exact cost? It's a nightmare in practice. It actually is. And so I would caution that when you see cost of goods sold, it's really not as simple to calculate as you might think it is. One thing, of course, also is that a service company probably wouldn't have a cost of goods sold. So, for example, you have started your own massage therapy business, okay? You don't have really a cost of goods sold, do you? you might have a little bit, you know, the oil that goes into one of your deluxe special massages. But how do you do that? If you buy a giant bottle of oil, do you measure how much you have left after you finished it? Or something like that. So really, in a case like that, there's not, it would be difficult to say there's a cost of goods sold. So in a service-related business, you probably won't see that COGS. Or if you do see it, it will be minimal based upon a few things that you really can attribute to the specific revenue. So the COGS, cost of goods sold, probably wouldn't be there for every company that you looked at. And if it is there, it might not be for the whole company. Some companies have products they sell and then services. So the COGS would be only related to their products. One way or the other, you get down to this line right here. Gross income or gross profit. Really? Gross income or gross profit. That's gross. And that is essentially taking out all the costs that you could directly relate to the items that you sold. You get your gross. Now then down the grinder, you get your SG&A. And I'm actually doing these kind of backwards because usually something else comes first. Sales, general, and administrative expenses. And the list can go on and on. Accounting gives us the framework in which we can break down what goes into what categories. What was a salary? What was a wage? What was a utility bill, electric bill, mailing costs, meals and entertainment, travel expense, mileage, all that kind of stuff. This SG&A would be broken down into a whole bunch of categories internally. And we kind of like to see those as financial analysts. But generally speaking, you're probably on the financial statements that you would see that would be publicly posted. It might be just a simple, straight one line, sales, general, and administrative expenses. Although you note that internally there were a whole bunch of categories. And sometimes it's just maddening to figure out what categories you want to use. Because one of the worst things in the world is, business-wise, you might have all these different categories. As I have done for years, I break all these things down into different categories. But then when you go to prepare your taxes, they don't want to see all those categories. They want their own categories, which might be kind of difficult to relate to the categories that you've been using for your internal bookkeeping and accounting kind of work. So then you have to rearrange, oh, Lord, I kept all of my expenses in these categories, these 12 categories, but now I have to figure out how to put those into these six categories that the IRS wants them in for reporting for tax purposes. So it kind of gets a little complicated there. Now the next one, and remember, in here, the accounting is going to say, what bills did you incur? And then you're going to have to go over and look at the accounts payable to see if accounts payable went up. You'll have to take back out the amounts that weren't paid, that just accrued in the accounts payable. So the reality of what we care about in finance is not going to be exactly what we see here in the SG&A, because we know that there are expenses that the company is writing here in SG&A that it never paid yet, and those will have to be found in the balance sheets from one year to the next, or one period to the next. The next one is a great big depreciation. And this is the depreciation expense for the current period. Here's the problem with it. It is not something that you actually pay. There's no company called depreciation you wrote a check to. It is the accounting way of recognizing over a period of time a giant expense. If you bought a really nice car,
Let's say it's a $50,000 car. No, wait. I saw a car. It was on the news. It's a white gold Mercedes for $1.24 million, something like that. White gold. I mean, that's pretty cool. If I mean, I don't know where you would drive it. Bird, you touch this car, and you'll die. Okay, anyway. Okay. Now, that's $1.24 million out of your pocket. That's the real cash flow that happened. You paid that amount of money. But the accounting rules will not allow you to say expense of $1.24 million. They'll make you break it up over a period of years so that we have to say, all right, if you put, okay, this depreciation, that doesn't mean anything. So we got to add that back in to look at cash flow. But we will have to take out of, as a real expense, the whole $1.24 million, which is not going to be anywhere to be seen on your income statement. So that, we know, is one of those non-cash things that we're going to have to add back in when the at the end of the day. Now, you get all that out of the way, and here we go. We have what is called operating income. Operating income. Operating income. The other name for this, which you'll hear me often use interchangeably, is EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. Earnings before interest and taxes. So be sure you know that when I say, well, your operating was, that, or then in the next sentence I say EBIT was, they're the same thing. The same thing. Now, if you look at financial statements that are reported and you can find them in at different websites, usually they'll use the term operating income. They won't use EBIT. So be aware, but sometimes that's what they use is earnings before interest and taxes. Okay, here comes the next one. After we've done that one, we take out our interest. How much interest we have paid out for our debts. You've got $100 million in 8% bonds, then through that year, you would have $8 million in interest you paid out. That's what it is. It's just how much interest you paid. Be a little cautious because I've been seeing financial statements. There are a lot of reporting services like Yahoo and Google. They will take the originals, which are at the SEC, and they will repeat them onto their websites. For some reason, the interest doesn't show up sometimes. And I was a little surprised when I was looking. I was lazy. I went to Yahoo Finance to look at a financials, and I saw zero interest. And I thought, that can't possible. Oh, well, I guess it is. And then it was only later when I looked at the SEC filings, wait, there's the interest right there, and it's big. And it's just that it wasn't showing up in the aggregators that Yahoo was using. And I've seen that over and over again, so be a little careful about that. Anyway, so you get that done, and here we come down to your earnings before taxes, EBT. EBT. And finally, you get the tax. Minus tax. And this is as complicated as hell. I'll get into that part this lecture, but then I'll take that. Instead of trying to plow everything in one lecture, I'll talk about tax for the most part on Tuesday. But finally, we get to the thing that is what we were interested in to start this. Net income. Sometimes you'll hear us call it net. Net income. how much you finished up with at the end of the day. Realistically, we get into this when we actually do financial analysis next week, but there are a couple of things. Which is, madam, which is better, a company that makes $1 million or a company that makes $10,000? Why? Why? Well, yeah. I mean, anytime you make a profit, you kiss the ground. It's a deeper thing, too. Well, suppose that the company that made $1 million, remember, that belongs to shareholders. Debt holders have been taken care of for the period. So $1 million belongs to the shareholders. What if there are 1 million shareholders? The net income per shareholder, 1 million shares. So the net income per share is $1. But the $10,000 profit company had one shareholder. So the net income per share for him would be $10,000. So net income really doesn't mean all that much in and of itself. You have to look at it on a per share basis. How many shares are outstanding? And so that would be something that you would be interested in. Your earnings per share. By the way, you'll hear this term net income. Sometimes you'll hear me use the word earnings. They're not exactly the same, but for me they are. So sometimes it's worth it to divide by the number of shares outstanding to see the earnings per share. That's a nice thing to know about. Another thing that we will talk about later is let's ask ourselves, the net income divided by the revenue. The net income divided by the revenue, what we call net margin. So that would be more, things like that are kind of more important than net income at the end of the day. So I could say this net margin, which is kind of interesting to me, is your net income divided by your net revenue. That means how much of every dollar that you pulled in stayed there for the shareholders at the end of the day. Net income per net income divided by net revenue. Now that's an interesting thing in itself, because you can see some companies with net income divided by net revenue. It might be for industry A, this net margin might be 20%. 20 cents of every dollar that they take in, they still have after all their bills are paid. But then you could have another industry where you have a 2% net margin. In other words, for every dollar that that company takes in, only 2% of it stays at the bottom line.
So is that cash?
Not exactly cash flow. You're going to have to play with something called FCF, free cash flow, but it's a proxy. Think of it this way. It's not the true story that we care about, but it's a window on the true story. Well, let me ask you, which industry is better? The one that has 20% net margin or the industry that has 2% net margin? Well, that's a very good point right there. You deserve a couple of cookies for that one. You know, the double Oreo, you know. I don't know why they call those the double Oreo. They should call those the Oreo, and then the ones that aren't double, they call the Oreo light. But anyway, where the hell was I? Will you concentrate, please? Okay. There's another thing, too. Interestingly enough, you will have some industries that just normally have profit margins, what net margins, that are in the 20, 25, 40% range. That's just the way it is. But then you'll have other industries where it is not surprising if you have a 1% net margin. In other words, a penny of every dollar makes it to the bottom line. That doesn't mean those are bad industries, because those are industries, you could talk about an industry like the oil industry. The companies, those giant monster oil companies, they have extraordinarily small net margins. But their revenues are in the hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. So a penny on every dollar of theirs is still a whopping amount of money to that the shareholders can claim. So it doesn't really mean much. You have to do an industry comparison to say whether or not a given company's net margin is really not good or is too good. The moral of that story is that when we get to ratio analysis, we are going to find that it's not really a matter of whether a ratio is too high or too low. It's a matter of what you're wanting out of that industry and what industry standards and normal industry ratios are. So that, there you go. Oh, by the way, let me point out something here. And I've said this before, now let me hit it over the head real hard. This net income, now we're pretending that this is what the financial people care about. That net income is what belongs to the shareholders. The shareholders have the claim on this residual. Net income is the residual. All of their bills have been paid. Their quick bills, their, you know, the ones that are month to month or quarter to quarter, they've been paid up here. The debt holders, the bond holders and note holders were paid at this line. So whatever we see, and then Uncle Sam and the states and the municipalities and whatever else, they were taken care of at the tax line. So all of the prior claimants are finished for the period by the time we get to net income. So that net income is what belongs to the shareholders. That's theirs. And there are two things that can be done with net income. And it's a trade-off. Net income you can either give it to the shareholders as a dividend, or you can reinvest it as plowback. Now, if you give it to the shareholders as a dividend, they get to put it in their pocket and go buy lunch. But if you put it back into the company itself, reinvest it, plow it back, that will give the company the ability to grow. So that would theoretically anyway cause the value of the shareholders' stock to go up. So the shareholders can either have their money now as a dividend and do what they want with it, or you can put it back into they can have it back into the company so that they realize a capital gain, at least the probability, the chance of a capital gain. There's no guarantee. So shareholders want their dividends, and that's the thing that we ask all the time. Why do you want a dividend if you think our company's good? We should be putting this money back into our company because we can make your stock price go up by increasing the shareholders' value by reinvestment. If you want that money, we don't have it anymore and we can't make your company grow. We can't make our company get more valuable if we give you the dividend. So we have to do a trade-off. We give them dividend to the extent that we can shut them up and give them a signal that we are healthy enough that we can give money away. But we also recognize that we have to keep most of that money for the company itself so that we can grow the company, so that we don't have to borrow more money or sell more stock to get money. We can use the earnings of the company itself to grow the company. It's a tricky business. Early in the life of a company, when I was a consultant, I helped companies that were going public, little companies, real small companies, that were going public or they had been they had gone public. And you would go to these shareholder meetings and the shareholders would be sometimes like a rabble. Where the hell is a dividend? You've been in business now, what, 3 years and we ain't seen no dividend? Where's that dividend check? Because I need to buy some stuff and I haven't had a meal at Denny's in years. And my brother-in-law, he needs bail money. I'm not surprised. Okay. And I would end up being the one who had to deal with this. You know, as a consultant, I'd sit there with the board of directors. What do you say to them? Look, you stupid cow. I wasn't like that. Yes, I was. You want a dividend? We're trying to get this company on its feet. Every penny we earn, we are grateful for because we can get that back into the company and we can try to grow the company. Instead of that, I can give you the money and then we won't grow, or I'll go to the bank and borrow money and they're going to charge me out the ass for money because we're such a risky enterprise still. So it's difficult. Eventually, you start giving dividends just to shut the shareholders up, show them that basically you're rich, you're doing well enough that you can give them something that you could have used more yourself. But at the same time, you recognize that every penny you give to those shareholders, that's that stock that won't go up by that much in the next period. Enough of that. Balance sheet. Balance sheet. Your assets. There's the current assets. Really? And then there is the current assets. Assets, geez. And then there's the long-term assets. Now, the long-term assets, of course, that's your gross investment in plant and equipment minus accumulated depreciation. I can't believe I can actually do this with it so easily. And that gives you your net fixed assets. Take your current and your long-term all together. Sorry, right there. And that gives you your total assets. That's one side of the balance sheet. And making this as quick as I can before it makes me feel funny doing accounting. Liabilities. Oh, I should point out here. Current assets. See if you've actually remember anything about your accounting. Madam, give me a current asset.
Cash.
Oh, that was cheating, okay? No, really? That's good. Yeah, that's actually the fastest one. We usually say cash and marketable securities. In other words, stuff that you can get back to the bank and unload real fast. Cash or cash and marketable securities. Yeah, okay. Okay, you got by with it. Now it's up to you. Give me another one. Current asset.
Capital?
Nope. Capital is long-term. Every time you say the word capital, that's going to be a long-term thing. Anyone? You got one? Well, what? Your car? No, that's long-term.
Inventory.
How about one before that? Is there one before that? Anything? Wait. What the hell is before? Oh, okay, I know. What is? You've got cash and marketable securities, and then down here is inventory. There's usually a couple right between those. That's... No, that would be fixed. Accounts receivable is next. AR, accounts receivable. What you've sold that they haven't paid you for yet, the sons of bitches. And then there's another one, which is kind of a creepy category. It's your accruals. You've paid like your insurance for the year, but you can't keep it all. You can't expense it all at once, so you have to put only each month in there, but the rest of it you have to put on the current assets that you really haven't. You paid the whole insurance for the year, but you don't get to take but one month at a time off it, so you have that accrual that kind of parks in there. It's not really very important. The biggies are cash and marketable securities, accounts receivable, and inventory. Am I forgetting one? No, I don't. Short term. No, that's probably about it. Okay. Anyway, now your long-term assets, that's your building, your plant and equipment, and then also there is, you take away your depreciation, marking it down period by period by some accounting rule like double declining balance or sum of years digits, which I'm sure you remember vaguely, or straight line depreciation. And then there's another one. You also have a category in long-term that's not physical assets, but it's intellectual property. goodwill, copyrights, and patents. And they don't call that depreciation, but it really is. But if it's for non-tangibles, intangibles, we call it amortization. So, but we, in finance, we just call it all depreciation. And there's your total assets. Liabilities. You have your current liabilities, and most of that is like accounts payable is the biggie. And then you'll have accruals, like if you owe wages but you haven't paid them yet, that would show up there too. Accruals for wages and salaries. Sometimes when you owe interest, you will say, well, we've paid the interest. That goes on your income statement, but you haven't written the check yet. So you might have accrued interest payable, or the current portion of a long-term debt that's ready to be paid. You'll have those in there. What else would be a... Those are the biggie categories for current liabilities. And then you have your long-term liabilities. That is mostly your bonds outstanding. You borrowed $100 million. As long as that bond is still out there, there's $100 million sitting there in your long-term liabilities. Sometimes you'll have some other long-term stuff in there that's not very important. But there's your, all those together make your total liabilities. And then you have your owner's equity. You have your common stock, at par, and then you have your additional paid in capital. Those two together make up your common stock. Now, I've seen companies, some financial statements more recently, where they don't break these two down. And really, it's kind of hard to explain why they're still broken down. It was a historical thing. Since time immemorable, since corporations were founded, common stock would be issued with a little tiny par value on it. The idea was that this would be what the owners would be personally responsible for. So if you issued, let's say, 100,000 shares of common stock, par value, 1 penny per share, and you sold that common stock for, let's say, $20 per share, the requirement on a financial statement, on the balance sheet, would work like this. Okay, you sold 100,000 shares times $20 per share, so you took in a total of $2 million. But you're not allowed to write it like that. You have to do it like this. You say $100,000 shares, the par value of those shares is a penny each. So there's $1,000 par value. So the way they required that you do it, and don't get confused about this, just add the two stupid numbers together. But the way they required that you do it, since time immemorable, was that you had to say, you had to report it on the financial statement, common stock at par is $1,000 $1 million plus additional paid in capital counts for $1 million. Let me see. $1,999,000. Is that right? Yes. So your total common stock, and this is why I'm not an accountant, comes out to be the right number that you actually took in when you sold the stock, $200,000. Were you taught this in your accounting class? Did they show you this? I don't know, even know if they show it anymore, but the problem is on financial statements, sometimes you'll see this breakdown. All that matters, for God's sake, is that stupid number right there. See that number right there? That's the only one that matters. But you'll see it broken down in this weird way because of that historical thing about par value. I formed a corporation, it was last year when I formed Emergent Light Studio, and they said, what's the par value of your stock? A lot of companies want just say par value zero, so they don't have to do this anymore. But for some reason, they wouldn't let me declare a par value of zero. So I just said par value of the stock is a penny a share. But anyway, enough of that. Let me get the owner's equity down here. Owner's equity. The first thing will be that common stock line, which would be that weird calculation of those two pieces above it. Sometimes companies aren't even bothering to report it anymore. A lot of companies still do, though. Okay, then you would have how much money the company had accrued through sales of stock and revenues and net income at the beginning of the period. And then you would say, plus net income that they took in this period, minus any dividends. So you would have plus the net minus dividends. You would take that. That would be your contribution to retained earnings for the current period. And then you would add those two lines together. Retained earnings at the beginning plus contribution, and you would have your retained earnings at the end. You take your common stock plus your retained earnings at the end, and that gives you your total owner's or shareholder's equity. God, this is a lot like work. Okay, there. That's how you get the net. And then you add that to the total liabilities. So in other words, net income, $1,000. Retained earnings, January 1, let's say $8,000. Dividend paid out of that, the net income, you paid a dividend of $100. And the common stock of the company, adding those two lines together, was $10,000. So, owner's equity, would be the common stock, $10,000, there. And then we would take the retained earnings on January 1, $8,000, add in $1,000 of net income minus a dividend of $100,
And so we'd have 8,000, 9,000, 8,900. And then we would add those two numbers up so that at the end, the owner's equity position would be $18,900.
Now, if you followed that, you're in good shape. Yeah, the 8,900 to the 10,000. See, because that was what was there before this period started. Okay, this period we pulled in 8,000. We had $8,000 in retained earnings to start with. We pulled in $1,000 in new income, and then we hacked out $1,100 to pay them. Now, if you followed that, whatever. Now, I'm going to tell you, what I'm going to do is on Tuesday, I'm going to go through with you, and we're going to work a problem together, part of a problem. Once we've worked that one problem together, I'll have you take a quiz, an online quiz. Part of that online quiz will be what I do in class. So it's going to be worth your while to write like a boss so that you can get at least a few points on it. In other words, I'll do one problem where I'll show you how to do it. And then on the quiz, that problem will be there and another problem that's sort of like it. And that will be two parts of that quiz. So that should help you get at least some chance of a good score. But for the weekend, just read and check my website, isu-prof.com. There's some extra outside readings you might want to do. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.